Welcome to Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill, Maine, and at WERU.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. As a lifelong musician and crafter, I am thrilled to be presenting my areas of interest and passion to you on our wonderful community radio station right here in my Orland backyard. On today's show, we will chat with several wonderful guests. Larissa Picard from the Pejebscot Historical Center will discuss portraying historical figures in a house museum. Julia Gray from the Wilson Museum will unpack question 3, the ballot measure regarding restoration of historic community buildings, for us. And Chip Stubbs will describe his journey as a citizen and volunteer involved in restoring the guardhouse at the old mill site in Bucksport in order that it may be a museum. Welcome to Creative Maine, Larissa Picard. You are the executive director at the Pejebscot History Center, and I'm so glad to have you on the show. I've enjoyed your campus myself, and I'm very anxious to hear what you have to say. We are going to talk today about the Joshua Chamberlain House Museum. And I'd like you to tell us what your role is at the History Center, and talk to us a little bit about your background and how you came to be in this position, and a little bit about your organization.
Well, thank you, Adina, so much for inviting me to be on your show. I really appreciate it. So I am executive director, as you say. I've been here for just over 9 years and was at the State Historical Society prior to that. Been in the humanities world probably for 25 or plus years, but in museums specifically since about 2009. And have really loved being here at Pejebscot History Center because it's such a, we have such a diverse collection. Our history dates back to, as a organization, it dates back to 1888. We are the fourth oldest history collecting organization that's not a state agency in the state. And so this region, you know, has a lot of rich history, as all parts of Maine do, but we serve Brunswick, Topsom, and Harpswell, Maine. And there's just an incredible amount of personages and events and just eras in history that were very significant for Maine's history, for national history here. And so it's never a dull moment. Every day is something fun. There's always a treasure to be found in the collection that one hadn't seen or knew of before. So it's great.
That's what makes it so much fun.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your organization. I know you operate a couple of house museums.
We do. We have two house museums, and we have since 1982 and 83. We came into possession of both of them in those years. One is the Joshua Chamberlain Museum. We're here to talk a little bit more about him today. And the other one is the Schofield Whittier House, which is a three-generation house museum, really goes from the mid-19th century all the way up to the latter part of the 20th century. So, yeah. And then we have, you know, a local history collection beyond those two house museums of about 200,000 plus items.
Oh, my word.
So, a lot going on.
Yes, I would say so. So, a historical figure's home is a good place to tell their stories. And what fascinates me about house museums is that it can be a time capsule for the individual. I think Schofield Whittier House is definitely a time capsule.
Oh, yes.
But the Chamberlain House is open a little bit more to different kinds of interpretation. I think that's fair to say.
That's correct.
So how can you set up a home to best tell the stories about the individual who lived there?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that we continually talk about here and think about. And it's sort of an ever-changing, we're always talking about that, because I think it's important to continually make sure that the story we're telling is well, certainly accurate, but also fresh, that addresses, you know, things that people want to hear, that connect to contemporary issues in one way or another. So with regard to the Chamberlain Museum, we are, we have two very different house museums. The Schofield House is full of stuff. It is a time capsule. They left everything in the house. That's both a great pro, but it's also very challenging to move things around and do new exhibits and that sort of thing in there. The Chamberlain Museum has some incredibly important featured items, such as his Medal of Honor, his Gettysburg boots, his horse's saddle, the family's original parlor furniture, his governor's desk. But it's not so jam-packed that we can't also use some of the spaces to tell additional stories in there. And I think, you know, you have to balance, people want to see the original items that the family used, that, you know, Chamberlain, the revolver he held, or the, you know, obviously the boots he was standing in, they want to see that and they want to connect with that. But you also have to, I think, have space to, space for both the docents who are taking people on a tour, or if we're doing a special event or activity in the house, to be able to just have flexibility to tell different stories and not, you know, have the only thing that we can do in the house be the standard house tour.
Sure.
So having rooms, having spaces that have more flex space in them, I guess, is really important to a house museum.
Well, one of the things that prompted our interview today is a book that I received. It's The Major Writings and Autobiography of Joshua Chamberlain. It's just coming out from Down East Books, and it's edited by Thomas Desjardins. And it's interesting to me, you know, if you think in more modern terms, somebody writing their autobiography is analogous to maybe an online influencer, and these people make their lives look perfect, right? They, you know, you come into their home on a YouTube video and everything's beautiful and everything's set up just right and the food is perfect and the children are scrubbed and shining or whatever. But, you know, when you think about someone like Joshua Chamberlain, he was one of Maine's most impactful citizens in his time. And very few portrayals of historical figures are totally impartial and neutral, because they are so famous and they are so lauded in their time. So when you set out to tell Chamberlain's story and interpret his life and times, how do you choose which stories to tell and how to tell them?
That's a great question. I think that that's something that house museums and any historical site that features an important figure has definitely struggled more with or dealt more with over the past several, you know, decades, really looking hard at those questions. We don't want to just tell the hero of Gettysburg story. We don't want to just tell the Chamberlain on a pedestal story. Many of our visitors do come to the museum because they have, you know, watched the movie Gettysburg or Ken Burns's Civil War series or Red Killer Angels, and they are just really, truly in love with Chamberlain and are coming to a site that has been on their bucket list and that sort of thing. So we realize that, and they do get some of that. They get the room with all of the treasures in it. But we also aim to really give them a full picture of not only Chamberlain's life, but his wife, Fanny, who has a fascinating biography herself. Mm-hmm. They were both very complicated people. And I think we do address the major times in his life, the major errors, the war, his time as governor of Maine, his time as Bowdoin president. But we also try to look at, some of the challenges that he had, some of the failures that he had. You know, he was involved in a very, very difficult capital punishment case when he was governor. And there were some folks during that time that were very unhappy with him. There were many complexities to that case, and it's not an easy case to deal with, but it's something that has to be addressed. The man in question was Black that was put to death. And so that's a real, that's a real challenging time in his biography. Also, there was a letter that Fanny, wrote to him during his time as governor as well, where she, a letter that he wrote to her that said, "I hear you've been telling people I've hit you and you want a divorce." And we have no letter from Fanny. We have no other evidence. There's nothing to explain, the further story of that. So I think, we have to raise those stories and be honest with people, because we're all human beings. I think people in the end, yes, they might want to see somebody on a pedestal, but I think they want to know that these people are human just like they are.
Absolutely. And you were saying you found some letters, and there's from his wife and so forth. So where do you go for interpretive source material? I mean, he's written quite extensively about his Civil War gambit, but he did a lot of things afterward. Where do you go for that information?
Yeah. So in the case of the letter that he wrote to Fanny, saying, "I hear you've been telling people this stuff," that's in the collection of Bowdoin College. And Bowdoin does have a significant collection of Chamberlain-related material, certainly relating to his presidency there and that era of his life, which was in the 1870s into 1880s. Certainly the Maine State Archives has other material, primary source material that is about Chamberlain and the family, others that were in state government with him, his time as governor. That's an incredible resource as well. So I think, there, the Library of Congress, there are the National Records Administration, they all have information on Chamberlain. There are quite a few different archival sources. I mean, we have a lot of stuff in our own archives as well. Plus, we have lots of copies of things that are in other archives for researchers to use here at Pajepscot. So there's a lot out there. People just have to dig a bit further to go beyond the war.
So this sort of begs the question for me, why learn about Joshua Chamberlain? What lessons does visiting his home hold for today's museum goers? I mean, aside from seeing the boots and the metal, why do we want to learn about these historical figures?
That's a great question. And I think if you ask people that come to the museum, if you ask others, people on our board, other folks who are supporters of the museum, they will, most of them will probably use the word leadership. And we have a lot of folks who say, "Geez, I wish we had a leader like him again today." And that is not to set aside the complexities we've just talked about. It's actually to say, even leaders have problem spots in their biographies, for sure. But he did not back down from a lot. He was his own man. He did not back down, obviously, on Little Round Top. He did not back down during the 12-day crisis in the state of Maine at the State House, when there was a huge election crisis and there was an angry mob at the door of the State House threatening to break in. Doesn't that sound familiar?
Yeah.
And a lot of folks, including Ron White, who wrote a biography of Chamberlain that came out last year, call this kind of a bookend to Little Round Top, because this was later in Chamberlain's life when he was not when he was governor, but when he was head of the Maine militia. And he was called in to protect the state house. And he stood in the door and said, "You can kill me if you want, but you're not coming through here." And, you know, and people backed down. They weren't gonna do that to their general. He was somebody who stood up for what he believed, regardless of party. He sometimes clashed with his own party. He was his own person. He was articulate. He was a rhetorician, so he was an excellent speaker and writer. He overcame a lot in his life. He suffered for many, many years from his wound at Petersburg, which really should have killed him, almost did. And he managed to survive that thanks to a lot of incredible people. But I think he's a figure that people can look up to in so many ways, in real ways, that is not just sort of a cardboard cutout of a leader.
It was interesting to me. I was reading his autobiography, and way back in his life, when he was still a late teenager, I think, he got a job teaching school in Milford.
Yes.
And there's this story that he tells about how he dealt with these big bully boys who were taking down the schoolroom, sort of thing. And you can see the echoes of that in the later man. And I find that very telling, very interesting.
It is. I think, you know, a lot of things in our childhoods create lessons for us that we come to understand later in life that were really important in our early creation as individuals. And Another story that is significant that he repeated in his memoirs and things was that he, as a young man working on his parents' farm, working one day and the plow got stuck, and he asked his father, you know, how to get it unstuck, how to fix it, how to fix the situation. And his father said, "Do it, that's how." You know, and that was it. And he was left to his own devices to figure it out. And, you know, that's the opposite of helicopter parenting. We right. could probably do with a little bit more of that kind of parent saying, "Look, you got to figure this out yourself." And he recalled that story many times because, you know, I think it just was a significant moment in his life where he realized that sometimes we've got to figure it out for ourselves.
And meanwhile, he realized he could.
Yes.
So yes, it was empowering from that point of view.
Absolutely. So as a, you know, young man who had virtually no military training, went off to war. He was a professor, you know, very much an academic. But he told the governor, writing to the governor and saying, "Please, you know, please accept me for service." He said, "I know how to learn. You know, what I don't know, I know how to learn." And that kind of really describes many areas of his life. He was totally a polymath. He was very much a Renaissance man, and he loved to learn, and he loved to learn about many different things. And he, you know, he really just embraced education, both as a teacher and a learner himself. And that's why he was so successful in many areas of his life.
Absolutely. So please tell our WERU listeners how they may engage with Chamberlain and his history. What would you suggest?
Absolutely. Well, I would definitely suggest for the person who doesn't know a whole lot about him to pick up Ronald C. White's book, which came out.
On Great Fields, it's called.
Yes, On Great Fields. And it's also out in paperback now as well. And it's widely available. We sell it at our own shop and online, but it's widely available. Excellent, very readable, really talks about how his early life influenced the rest of his life. But it's a soup to nuts biography. I mean, it is a good biography and the first major biography in decades. There are, you know, I would say many people. The movie Gettysburg, which is 33 years old now or something, is still a big favorite among folks who fell in love with him. And it's a long movie, but it is an excellent movie. Jeff Daniels sort of made his name playing Chamberlain. Certainly coming to our museum, we do tours from May to October on a 5-day a week schedule, and we do private tours year round with about a week's notice. And people can find that out from our website and submit a request for that.
But would you give us the website, please?
Sure. It is PejepScotHistorical.org. And that's Pejepscot's a tough one. it's PejepScot historical.org.
Very good. And if listeners want to dig even deeper or maybe even volunteer at the museum, do research on Chamberlain's Maine or ask questions, is that the same website they would go to?
That is the same website. And we would love folks volunteering. We have volunteer spots in many aspects of the museum. We do year-round work here, year-round programs. We have research services. We have, you know, a lot of volunteers who work in collections, volunteers who give tours. So we love that. It's the same website, and the phone number is 207-729-6606.
Well, Larissa Pricard, it's been a wonderful, very informative interview. I've enjoyed it immensely. Thank you so much for coming on Creative Maine with us, and we look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it as well.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. This episode, we will highlight some local resources for holiday season activities. At the Farnsworth Museum in Rockland, admission is free every Sunday in December for Share the Wonder. For more information and a complete listing of events and classes at the Farnsworth, visit farnsworthmuseum.org/events. Saturday, December 21st, visit the Woodlawn Museum in Ellsworth for a winter craft and farmers market at the barn from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Also, from 5 to 7 p.m., walk a lighted trail and visit with Santa. For more information, visit www.woodlawnellsworth.org. On December 21st and 22nd, the Robinson Ballet and Bangor Youth Choirs will present The Nutcracker at the Collins Center for the Arts. There will be performances on Saturday the 21st at 2 and 7 p.m. and on Sunday the 22nd at 3 p.m. For tickets to this beloved holiday tradition, go to collinscenterforthearts.com. Next, we speak with Julia Gray about the importance of ballot measure 3, which passed on the last election.
Welcome, Julia Gray. I am thrilled that you agreed to come on Creative Maine with us today to talk about a very important topic and one that's quite timely. We're going to be discussing the importance and impact of ballot question number 3 in the recent election. But first, I'd like you to introduce yourself. I'd say, arguably, you're one of the premier museum professionals in the state of Maine. You've been at it quite a while. Tell us a little bit about your background and what you are doing right now.
Sure. So I'm coming to you today from the Wilson Museum in Castine on the shores of Castine Harbor, where I'm the executive director, and I've been here since 2021. I come from an anthropology and archaeology background, both in my undergraduate and my graduate school. I worked in archaeology to pay my way through college and grad school, but moved into museum work fairly soon after that. I started out with a short-term position at the Perry McMillan Arctic Museum at my alma mater, Bowdoin, and then spent more than 17 years at the Abbey Museum in Bar Harbor in a variety of collections and exhibit-related roles. I also did several years working as a consultant with museums and land trusts and other organizations around the state largely doing kind of exhibit and interpretive development, so museum exhibits, interpretive panels for land trusts, but also some kind of collection storage space planning, collections care planning, and that sort of thing. And then started here at the Wilson Museum again, I said, in September of 2021. And this was my first foray into being responsible for historic buildings in a really significant way. Certainly at the Abbey Museum, the Abbey, original Abbey Museum in Acadia National Park is a historic building on the National Register, but that was secondary to a lot of my work. And here as the executive director, I am ultimately responsible for the care of three historic buildings, one of which is on the National Register and one of which is in the process of getting listed. So
we're going to be talking about this resolution number 3, and I think you're uniquely positioned to discuss this. The resolution allows the state to borrow $10 million to restore historic buildings owned by the government or nonprofits if they can get at least 25% local matching funds. So can you explain historic restoration, preservation, conservation, maybe the differences between them and what we're looking at?
Sure. With a caveat that this is an area that I've been learning about for the last couple of years. So I'm sharing kind of what I've learned from other professionals that we've been working with. But coming from a collections care standpoint, it's kind of a matter of scale. So there's kind of two ways that you're caring for historic or cultural heritage, history heritage resources, whether it's an object or a building. And one is to prevent damage, to prevent harm from coming, so preventative care. And then there's the kind of response when harm does happen or when degradation happens, and then things have to be repaired or action has to be taken that addresses that damage. When it comes to buildings, historic buildings, there's a set of standards that come out of the Department of Interior, kind of through the National Park Service. They oversee the National Register that it breaks this down into some different categories around how you approach a historic building, and their preservation, rehabilitation, restoration, and reconstruction. And they are really, you make decisions about which approach to take based on kind of what you're expecting for an outcome from that treatment of your historic building. If your preventative care has not kept up with whatever is happening to the building, that so that it's suffering damage or it's things are breaking down and so on, then you have to make a decision about whether you want to kind of have this frozen in time exactly as it was in 1815, in our case, 1765, exactly as, or whether you can replace, if it's reached a point where you have to replace historic materials with new materials to keep the building up and standing, to in reconstruction. So like if something is lost and you have enough information, is there value to completely reconstructing that so that you recreate the experience, the presence, the look of that historic building, but you're not actually dealing with that, with the historic fabric. So it's kind of a continuum of how you approach historic buildings that, again, is really guided by what you need for outcomes and how you expect to use that historic structure going forward.
I think anyone who owns a home will be familiar with all the things that can and do go wrong. And if you make the building 100+ years old, you're just compounding these things. So I think people can definitely relate to that continuum. And this brings up the concept of cultural heritage and cultural heritage at risk. This was a phrase that I heard recently, and it really resonated with me. People understand heritage in terms of our holidays and things that we do to preserve our identities as one thing or another. But when you're talking about actual things, objects, depending, as you said, on the scale, what does cultural heritage at risk mean? And why is the preservation of historic buildings particularly so important to our culture, our society, and our communities, and dare I say, our identities? And do you feel that the passage of this bill will also help stimulate tourism in Maine?
Sure. So hopefully I'll remember to hit all of your questions in the course of answering. So the concept of cultural heritage at risk, kind of some of the language around that really comes from some work that started in the mid-2000s around museum collections, so object collections in museums, and the recognition that all of the information and value that was held in these archives and museum collections around the country were probably not getting the investment that they needed to really be preserved and protected for the long-term future. And for a variety of reasons, largely a lack of investment of funds and resources. And so there were two studies done around museum collections in 2005, and then there was an updated version done in 2019 that looked at what was happening, what the risks were, how they were exacerbated, what we might do as a society to kind of better invest in our cultural heritage. And I think there's a couple of different reasons why. I mean, I'm an objects person. Like, I love material culture. So I think that there's parts of our history, there's knowledge about our history, about our cultures that are embedded in our buildings, in our objects, that are not necessarily documented in the traditional historical record in terms of writing. Increasingly, so I mean, certainly traditionally, a lot of the kind of like historic house museums were about really important, famous people who were well documented. You've got, you know, all the you know, Montpelier and Monticello and George Washington's home and so on. But increasingly, in the last couple of decades, there's been a recognition that some of these cultural heritage resources that are physical houses and objects are carrying stories that aren't necessarily well represented in the written history. And you can learn about regular people's days. You can learn about enslaved people. You can learn more about women in their domestic sphere. You can learn more about poor people in their daily lives. So there's knowledge embedded in these historic places that can convey things that isn't necessarily in the historical record. But also, certainly, as communities, we place value on our history, and there are ways that our buildings really convey that that's differently from other sources of information. Also, I think people learn differently from physical things. I think if you can see and be in a space, people who don't learn well from books might be able to learn more from something like physical cultural heritage. So there's a lot of different ways that I think that it has value. And I think oftentimes there's community stories that are embedded in these historic spaces, especially when we talk about things like Grange halls and Masonic halls, like all of these kind of really important historic buildings and churches and so on in our communities. And many of these cultural heritage resources are being cared for almost entirely by volunteers who are aging in many cases. So they don't have the personnel that can give the care that they need. There's oftentimes not a lot of money being invested, and we all know what deferred maintenance leads to, yes. Whether it's in your home or whether it's in the national parks or a road. So deferred maintenance is a problem. And then compounding that is the impacts of climate change. So mm-hmm. climate change tends to exacerbate all of the things that shorten the life of historic buildings, of historic objects, everything from we know that moisture and heat are really hard on any of these on these buildings, especially when they were built for the conditions in Maine in the 1700s or 1800s. Natural disasters, whether that be a hurricane or a fire, are obviously really detrimental to any of these historic places. So you had the gradual loss of cultural heritage through a lack of investment, relying on volunteers to do a lot of the work to care for these historic places. And then everything is speeding up with climate change, sometimes mm-hmm. dramatically. So, I mean, we've all seen the footage of the fish houses down in southern Maine washing away in the January storms.
Yes.
Impact on lighthouses, which are one of our most iconic kind of historic cultural heritage landscape, buildings.
Yes.
So what we know about what harms these objects, these buildings, is all just made,
worse,
geometrically worse by climate change. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So the need is getting more dire and important if we're to maintain these physical connections to our past.
Yeah.
Very important. So now that the measure has passed, who decides which projects get funded and what are the parameters for organizations who may want to apply for funds?
Sure. So we don't know a whole lot of detail yet. So what we do know is that the administration of these funds and the development of the grant program to distribute the funds will be handled by the Maine Historic Preservation Commission. And they've got some good information right on their homepage right now about the status of it. They'll be working on developing the grant program over the next year or so. They're expecting to post the first grant application process towards the end of 2025. So they're kind of figuring out what the detailed parameters are. Some of the things we do know based on the bond, on the legislation that was enacted by the bond issue, is that it would be buildings that are under the ownership of either a governmental or nonprofit organization. So your state or local government, a nonprofit. So it's not going to apply for privately owned built historic buildings. Eligible buildings need to either be listed currently on the National Register of Historic Places or have been determined to be eligible in the process, but nominated for the National register by the Maine Historic Preservation Commission, and you need to be able to raise a match. So they're asking for a 25% local match, which is actually isn't too bad. A lot of grants are often like a 1-to-1 match. But basically what they're asking is that whatever, whether it's the local government or nonprofit, that you're investing some of your own resources in it, whether that's through fundraising or we'll see if there's like if you can have like in-kind donations in terms of like some of the work by contractors being a match, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then also, and you will have to adhere because it's funding through the government for National Register properties, you will have to adhere to the Department of the Interior standards for the work, which MHPC, Maine Historic Preservation Commission, administers that so that all projects will go through that review. And interestingly, in reading what's on their website, you will also be asked to put a preservation easement on the historic property that will be held by Maine Historic Preservation Commission. That varies depending on the more money you get, the longer your preservation easement will have to be. It'll be interesting to see how that actually gets worked out in the details, but it does mean that there will be an additional layer of protection through a preservation easement that will be put upon the building once they've invested the money. So you can't get the money, do the work, and then go and change it all and not follow those standards. So they're trying to keep those positive outcomes in place for a longer period of time.
Well, what comes to mind is, what might a typical restoration project look like? And can any construction company do the job? Are there specially trained artisans who engage in these projects? And we were talking before about what is best for a building to keep it in the long term, whether it's to redo the fabric of that building with modern construction things, or do you go to an old barn and find old barn wood and then put it, you know, why would these things matter, or do they matter?
So again, part of that is that you will be under the regulations of those standards, the historic preservation standards of the Department of the Interior. I don't know those in super detail, but there will certainly be the team at Maine Historic Preservation will be really, I think, really involved in guiding organizations and making sure that they're doing that work. Luckily, we have in our region, certainly in Maine, across Maine, we have such a wealth of skilled craftspeople that regularly, even for just current, you know, building new houses, know how to do, you know these traditional techniques, know how to work with hand tools for working wood. So I think that we're lucky in that we have a lot of our carpenters and our stone workers and our masons and our, you know, they have this experience because they're doing it a lot. So I think that there's probably a good range of folks that can do it. There may be some areas where there's specialization in it, certainly. And there are contractors that are listed, for example, through Maine Preservation, which is a statewide nonprofit that deals with historic preservation. There are certain things you need to know, and for example, in restoring historic windows and things like that. But I think that it will depend on what part of the project, whether it needs to be a specialized contractor or whether it's just someone who has the skill. And I think we have a wealth of folks that can do that kind of work.
Right. I noticed that you listed Maine Preservation's Professionals Directory.
Yeah.
So that would be a very important resource. Yeah.
It's a very good starting place. With the caveat, with the acknowledgement that's a pay to play listing. So the people that are on that list have paid to be on that list. So there are definitely, that's a really good starting place. There are more craftspeople who can do this kind of work, I think, certainly that are on that list, but it's a really great resource.
Very good. Well, if our listeners have some of these skills and wish to get more involved in historic preservation and restoration in their own communities, what can get them started?
Sure. So I would say if you own or care for a historic building, Maine Preservation is a great organization to connect through. They have programming that brings together craftspeople. They have, I think, every year they have some series of workshops for craftspeople to develop their skills around historic preservation skills. And they have online learning, they have conferences, and they have some great online resources. If your community has a local historic preservation commission, consider volunteering or working with that local historic preservation commission. Not all Maine towns do, but some certainly do. And that's a great way to contribute to how your community is approaching historic preservation community-wide. If you have these skills and you have the time, and there's a nonprofit, especially in your community, that needs this work to happen, and you are able to volunteer your time and your skills, believe me, there's opportunities for that. I think that there, we would, most of us nonprofits would welcome skilled volunteers to help out with the work that we're doing. And then certainly just advocating for historic preservation, both locally in your community, making sure that when decisions are being made, that the historical properties and historic resources are being considered. There was a really, I mean, part of the reason why we have this $10 million bond issue that passed is because there was some really significant advocacy for historic preservation and the bond going forward. And then there are organizations like the National Trust for Historic Preservation that does national advocacy for historic preservation that identify things like both Maine Preservation and the National Trust identify some of the most at-risk historic properties every year, both statewide in the state and nationally. So there's some good opportunities to learn and advocate for the built history that's in your communities.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. So this is such an important topic that I know that you and I will be revisiting this on Creative Maine, if you don't mind. I think there's a lot to be discussed in this realm. So where can our listeners go to connect with you or other people? What is a good contact point?
So I think, again, I think I mentioned before, Maine Preservation is a good, you know, finding them online, finding the National Trust for Historic Preservation online. If you go to Maine Historic Preservation Commission's website, which is on their state website, they have you can sign up for updates. And certainly folks, you know, if you want to know more about what's going on, and I can potentially connect you with other organizations that I know are dealing with trying to tackle their historic buildings, certainly don't hesitate to reach out to me at director@wilsonmuseum.org. And I think, Adina, you'll post some of these links and so on the notes that go with the show notes that go up on the ERU's website.
Absolutely. On the website and on the WERU phone app as well.
Oh, nice.
Well, thank you so very much. This has been a wonderful and very interesting conversation, and I wish you the best of holiday seasons and all the best with your own preservation and restoration projects.
Great. Thank you so much, Adina. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you. Welcome, Chip Stubbs, to Creative Maine. We are here to talk about your very exciting initiative to restore and repurpose a building in the old Verso Mill in Bucksport. And this building is being restored to its 1930 appearance to be a mill museum. And this effort is a great example of a local citizen-driven project to save an important piece of local history. So you're the man in charge of the volunteer crew at the old gatehouse, which is the building that you're restoring. So tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to be involved in this project.
Well, I grew up out here in Bucks Mills, and I've known Pat Ranzoni all of my life. My goal, I got involved in it from talking with Pat at Christmas time back in 2020 or 2021. We had stopped in and dropped off some Christmas cookies, and we got talking about the mill, and I had worked with her nephew, and it dawned on her that, you know, she should be asking me about my interest in writing something for the book. And so in the course of our conversation, she found out that I had shut number 5 paper machine down, which we called the Big Dog. And so I agreed to write her my story of it and my thoughts about the mill and about Verso. In the course over that time of conversing with her and corresponding with her back and forth about the storyline, we had touched on the museum, and I said I was interested in helping getting the place up and maybe not up and running, but doing some work on it, volunteering my time. In 2022, in September, we went down to the museum to take a look at it and have a little announcement that we were going to acquire it. And at that point, I was asked if I would be the foreman of this operation. And I said, well, I'm not sure that I'm qualified for that. But I said, I'll start out by helping and cleaning it up, getting the building cleaned out and you know, get some of the stuff started to go. Mm-hmm. you know, my goal in there is to preserve the history of the mill and papermaking. Our goal is to keep the memories alive and to share them through the Bucksport Paper Mill Museum.
And also, you were saying something about a tribute to the people who used to work there, too.
Yes. Working on this building, cleaning it, and everything of that nature, I'm thinking of the people that I worked with and the people that worked there before me that made this possible. And I'm looking at the building when we're in there cleaning and working on it, and I'm looking at the ceiling, which is part of the, well, it's the original building itself with no drop ceiling in it anymore. And there were wire racks and reinforcement rods up there. And I said, you know, we could pay a tribute to the past workers in the mill by hanging their lunch pails up there to show a respect for them.
Right. And all the work that they did.
Right.
Day in, day out. So this kind of brings me to the next question, which is, why is this particular building chosen as a focus for the preservation and the restoration? Was it that there weren't any other buildings left? Was it the right size? What are you thinking?
It's actually the only part of the original mill that was built in 1930. And basically it's the only one left. It's something that they really couldn't use for anything else, and they were willing to give it to us for a dollar.
Okay, that's the Price is Right. So the rest of this show that we're talking on has to do with preservation and restoration. And so here's this building from the 1930s, and so that would make sense why you would want to choose that one. So how did your volunteer crew come together? I know you were talking to Pat and you were, all on board, but how did you bring in other people?
A lot of it was there was three or four people that have been involved with the museum thoughts of having the museum. And that's actually the crew that we started out with was Ed and Larry and Leo and myself. And the initial
are these people who were all former workers at the mill?
No. Two of us were, Leo and I were former workers at the mill. Mm-hmm. And Ed is Pat's husband, who Pat's father worked at the mill. I don't think that Larry ever worked in the mill at all. A few people that have been around had worked there summers while they were in school. Mm-hmm. But as work was progressing on the building, my goal was to preserve that original third of the building, which was built in 1930, and to keep it as industrial looking as possibly could be. So what I did in early this spring was went in and pressure washed the whole interior twice. That really only required one other person to be there in case something happened. The initial cleaning of it, you know, we had three or four of us in there working, and that's all you needed because there were narrow hallways and stuff, and you'd be running into each other. But, you know, like I said, the goal is to keep this as an industrial looking as possible.
So you have a core of interested people.
Yep.
And they'll come when you need them, which is great. So you were talking about pressure washing, and what were some of the other nuts and bolts steps required to get the building ready to become a museum?
We had to get rid of all the junk that was in it, get that hauled to the dump or to recycling and stuff. We had to tear down some walls. There was one that was kind of unstable. We had to figure out, they had started to renovate that building and they had metal studding up there. And we wanted to blind nail V-match to it. So we had a good looking wall and something to fasten stuff to. So we had to come up with ideas on how to get around the obstacles that needed to be got around.
So are you building it in such a way that it can have exhibit walls or, you know, movable walls, or how are you preparing it for being a museum?
We're going to have it set up so it has exhibit walls. We're going to have display cases. We have a doorway that's been walled over that we've decided we're going to fancy it up and be able to put glass doors on it or plexiglass doors on it so we can put little intricate stuff in behind it and have it be protected.
Good. So you've got a sort of a plan beyond the cleanup of yes. how you want to fit it out. Yeah.
Yes. So we tore a couple walls down to make it a more open space.
Yeah, it's not huge as a space, but it's not small either, roughly.
It's roughly probably 24, 26 by, I think it's 120 feet long. Yeah. It's a narrow but long building.
Well, that's good enough to tell a story, yeah. isn't it?
Yep. We had to repair a spot in the floor, and with a great insight from my brother-in-law, we decided to paint it with yellow and black safety paint. It's a little uneven surface that eventually we'll have something placed over it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that just adds to the industrial nature of the feel
yep.
in the building. Yeah. Speak a little bit about the importance of old buildings to the heart and the health of a community. Why is it important to save the gatehouse of a defunct mill, in your opinion?
To keep the memory of the mill alive and to keep the memory of the people that work there. Papermaking is becoming a dying breed. And we would like to, young people of the future, at least have some idea of what happened there.
Well, it was a major industry all over Maine. And
yes.
So that in itself is important. So mostly as a teaching tool and a memorializing tool. Is that how you feel?
Yes.
Would you suggest to other communities that they should think about doing the same? I know that there are a number of defunct mills up and down the river. Would you say that this has been an important exercise to bring the community together?
I think so. A lot of people have been paying attention to what we're doing and watching us. I'm walking down the street and people make comments to me about how's it going and what I'm doing and that I'm doing a good job. I put out a flyer when I first started working on this that I was dropping off at individual stores and stuff in town. I think it's helped raise, I know it's raised awareness to it, but it's also helped with fundraising. The credit union gave us a substantial fund right after they saw the paperwork. So it's important to the community to keep themselves aware of its history.
Yes.
And we have people stop in, because I'm there every Tuesday from 8 to noon. As long as it's above freezing this winter, I'll be there. People have stopped in and just brought artifacts in that they wanted us to have. I had brought a gentleman in a month ago as a private viewing. And his daughter said, well, he would probably like to have some of the people there if you got a crew working. He'd like to talk with them and visit. And the twinkle in his eye and the twinkle in his voice, and I know there was a twinkle in his heart. He was just tickled pink to be there. And a week later, Gene called me back up and said, Chip, Dad wants to know if you're there. And I said, yep, I'm going to be here. He said, well, he's got something he wants you to have. He brought me a picture. It's probably been hanging on the wall of his house for over 70 years.
Wow.
And it was a picture of the Bucksport Mill baseball team. It was an article in the paper. They were going to play Ellsworth. And in the bottom half of that picture frame, he had a truck that was full of horses that they were taking up, I believe it was to Milo, to haul logs out of the woods for pulp. And he wanted the museum, he wanted that to hang on the museum walls.
Wow.
And it is there.
That's wonderful. Well, I guess I have a question too. Do you have a museum director or is it just you and a committee, or how are you charting the path going forward?
We have two people keeping track of donations. We do have a director, Julia, she has to do with the Castine Historical Museum.
Julia Gray?
Yes, yes.
She's actually on this interview with you. She's on this program with you.
Okay. No, we had a meeting June 8th, and there was a lot of the people that were what we call the working crew, and that's the people that are working to get the museum cared for, mm-hmm. I guess is the best way to put it. And Julia was there giving us some sense of direction on where to go. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we would like to do is get people to come in with stories of their feelings about the mill when they worked there, or even if they didn't work there, you know, if their parents worked there or somebody of that nature, you know, just to get some history that way of them. Touched on earlier about the tribute to the workers in the mill.
Yes.
Not everybody carried a lunch pail. And I was talking to a friend out to the lake one day, lady friend, and she said, you know, Chip, my grandmother Pat worked there. And I said, you just gave me a wonderful thought. I will hang the ladies' pocketbooks that they carried in that mill up on that ceiling as a tribute to them.
So please tell our Creative Maine listeners how they may visit the Mill Museum, become involved in other ways. How can they contact you or the organization and get involved?
All right. First thing and foremost, if you do get involved, the crew that's been working with me, I've been keeping track of their time, and we've got over 800 hours in there. And, you know, that's for future grants and stuff that it may help.
Absolutely.
To achieve. People can reach me at 207-299-5291 or on my email, which is chip9516@gmail.com. Okay, we also have a website that's up and running.
Yes.
And if you Google Bucksport Historical Museums, the Historical Society of Bucksport will come up along with the Paper Mill Museum. And my information is in there.
Okay, perfect. Well, this has been wonderful. I think this wraps up our discussion about preservation and restoration and very, very neatly. And it's a wonderful citizen initiative. And congratulations for your success.
Well, thank you.
And thank you so much for coming on with us. And I wish you the very best of holiday seasons and great success with the museum in the new year. Thank you so much to my wise and insightful guests, Larissa Picard, Julia Gray, and Chip Stubbs. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on WERU.org for another eclectic episode on January 16th at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we will learn about the creativity of heavy-duty sewing. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson wishing you a joyous holiday. As always, I wish you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.